Hello, this is Caroline Jones. Welcome to another edition of The Search for Meaning. This time, part two of Aboriginal Perspectives with Mary Graham, an elder of the Combermere people of Southeast Queensland, lecturer at Queensland University, consultant on Aboriginal affairs, member of the Corrective Services Commission, member of the Aboriginal Reconciliation Council established by the Prime Minister. Mary is a chess player, a devotee of Russian films, the mother of a son of 23, a freelance editor for Queensland University Press, and currently writing with Lilla Watson a book on Aboriginal perspectives. As a young woman, puzzled and alarmed by Western culture and behaviour, Mary took to the books for answers, to the classics of Western literature, poetry and philosophy. One of her favourites was Voltaire. He advised her to doubt everything. In the years since, Mary Graham's been on a long journey through the history of thought to arrive home to a reconfirmation of the validity of her own Aboriginal way. But that journey in education equips her brilliantly to draw insightful contrasts between the Western way and the Aboriginal way in their attitudes to individuality, to silence, to identity, to metaphysics. She talks about the need for a collective spiritual identity in Australia, of the vital necessity of knowing your own place, your own story, and of remembering that story over and over. She speaks of the Aboriginal understanding of what it is to be human and the necessity continually to practice that humanity. She speaks of the seduction of Western thinking, the naivety of democracy by contrast with consensus, the absurdity of the Darwinian theory of evolution, and the custodial ethic of Aboriginal tradition, and the experience of loneliness. Sitting with Mary Graham in her country on a hot Brisbane afternoon, I asked her if she ever knows loneliness.
Yes, sometimes. Sometimes in a group, in a crowd, I suppose, of Europeans. Because in a way, you're expected to be an individual. Do you know what I mean? When you're with other Aboriginal people, when an Aboriginal person is with other Aboriginal people, you're inextricably tied to them. Not because of culture, not because of racial, you know, but because of, to do with meaning, I suppose. That, for example, you don't have to talk, actually, in a group with Aboriginal people. You're allowed to be, in fact, you're quite often, silence is seen as a way of learning things. But if you're silent, it's quite okay. You don't have to fill the silence with chatter or anything like that. You can actually, you're allowed to be silent. So you are truly together with people, whether they're talking or not, whether you're discussing something or not, whether you know them actually even or not. But with Europeans, whether it's, in some kind of formal or informal gathering, social or whatever, sometimes it's very lonely because you're expected to kind of almost like perform, or you put on another mask. Even though the idea of negotiating in society, of course, Aboriginal people do that too. Everybody, you learn all the ways of negotiating. But for Murrays, that negotiation, it's tinged with a kind of, how can I put it? You're watching others, they're watching you, and you're watching yourself as you're watching others too, all the time. Which is also why alcohol is absolutely disastrous for Aboriginal people, because when that comes into it, all of that really old, very strong self-control way of negotiating, social navigation, I should say, it goes out the window. And then you don't watch your manners or protocol, you don't care about protocol and so on and so on. Whereas when, I think for Europeans, when they're navigating through society or going through society,
yes,
their role, what they do is more important. Do you know what I mean? So, for example, say I was a doctor and I'm giving a talk with nurses, that the relationship is very, very clear from the beginning, absolutely clear. But for Murrays, when we, in that protocol, when we introduce ourselves to each other, the whole idea is to say who we are and who our parents are. What that actually is doing is you're rehumanizing all the time. Because if there's one thing that Murrays have learned over a really long period of time, it's the easiest thing in the world to forget that you're human. You can forget it in about 5 seconds, you know. So the idea is that, it sounds crazy, but you have to keep practicing it all the time.
What's the alternative to being human? When you say it's easy not to be human, what is it that you can easily slip into?
Well, roles. You can fall into roles.
Right.
What do you do, you know, is far more important than who you are,
yes.
Of being human.
So the European way can easily distort that and pull you into roles and away from being the most important?
Yeah, that's right. In other words, it's being human is far more important than being a human being.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So acting it all the time and so on and so on. Because what would one say about the... what would one say about, say, the Nazi who kills thousands of people in a weekend, you know, in a gas chamber, and then comes home and is a very good family man and good to his children and so on and so on. Do you know what I mean? So what does it mean to be actually human? So for Murrays, they learnt over a long period of time that you actually, in a sense, have to practice it all the time. And what it basically is emphasising those human attributes. My mother is so-and-so, my father is so-and-so.
Telling the story over and over again.
Telling the story over and over again. For example, from an Aboriginal perspective, the story about Arthur and the round table and so on, from our perspective, it's not important to find scientific evidence or physical evidence of where that castle was or where did he live and how did he live. It would be far more important just simply to tell a story because the story is the thing. That's the telling stories all the time is the thing of rehumanizing. All the time.
So there's a great power in the story.
Oh, great power. It's not important that, Arthur was a king and that was his castle there in that particular place and here is the evidence. He's a rock or a brick from it and so on and so on. You know, so evidence or scientific, and roles and that sort of thing. It's not important so much.
Now, another thing that I find really interesting, Mary, when I'm talking to you and when I talk with other Aboriginal friends, I ask a question in terms of you. What was it like for you when you did so-and-so? And so frequently the answer will come back, not in terms of I, it'll be, well, we or Murrays or Aboriginal people. Now, explain that to me. I ask you as an individual and you answer me as a member of a group. Why is that?
See, learning that life... the meaning of life comes out of land, also taught Aboriginal people that that in order to look after land, in order to keep humanness, keep recreating humanness all the time, you actually, what you end up with is a custodial ethic rather than a controlling one, a controlling ethic that turns into agriculture and so on and so on. So, but in order to keep a custodial ethic going, and given that humans are what they are, with this great repertoire of human feeling and emotion, like jealousy and hatred, because it's normal to be jealous and hating somebody and so on, they found that you have to do something with the ego. So what they actually did was work out ways and means, all sorts of mechanisms by which the ego is allowed full display, but at the same time there's all kinds of ways of pressures on you to keep your ego back, so to be modest, don't brag, don't big note yourself, and so on and so on. Don't show off too much. But if you lose your temper, I mean, you have to do something with your temper, because, again, that's the human part of you, and you have to allow that out. You have to allow that. You can't sort of sit on it and say that, again, as we were saying before, conflict is bad or something. So you're allowed to express all of that sort of jealousy and hatred and so on. But one of the main mechanisms there was that you always had minders around to make sure that you didn't go too far. So to put it in a brief sort of way, the idea of Helen of Troy, in Aboriginal perspective, it would have been perfectly all right for two men to have a fight over somebody called Helen of Troy, have a duel about it. But the very idea of ideologising that conflict being far more organised about it and ending up with a huge war over somebody called Helen of Troy, a Hellenistic war, and millions of people dying, that is absolutely inconceivable for Aboriginal people, but it's perfectly normal to have a duel. The impetus is there for you to learn about things, to display your knowledge by the correct kind of behaviour. So it's not so much that you know things in an artificial or formal way, you know this and you know that and you talk about it, or that people think you know things, but you display your knowledge of things by your behaviour. So you have to behave in a modest way and don't show off and so on and so on and so on. So it's built in, you see. So that's why leadership, the idea of hierarchy is unknown. It's the nearest thing to a hierarchy in Aboriginal society would be a hierarchy of knowledge. And again, you're not given a label or a medal or there's no system of chieftains or anything like that. because again, if you had something like that where the ego could have that kind of free way, you'd end up very quickly with a hierarchy, and a hierarchy always mitigates against the custodial ethic. So all human societies have elites. Aboriginal people understood that too, because we're all different. Where some people are slow, and somebody's fast, and someone's quick, and some people are good at some things and not others. So you have elites, but there are mechanisms there by which those elites must not turn into a class or a caste system, because you'll end up with a hierarchy straight away again. And as soon as you have a hierarchy again, another way of looking at it is to look at that old, from an Aboriginal perspective, the old Greek myth of Narcissus, of a beautiful boy falling in love with his own image in the water. From our point of view, that is like the individual, the ego, discovering itself, and upon discovering itself, falls in love with itself. In other words, it becomes obsessed with self. It becomes obsessed with only its own concerns. Now, again, Aboriginal people understood that sort of thing too very well. There are stories, a lot of the dreaming stories are actually about psychology, about how to understand why we do the things we do, and that all possible contingencies, all possible behaviour of humans has been taken into account in those stories, including that kind of thing about being egotistical and almost like morality plays, I suppose. If you do this, this will happen. If you don't share, then something else bad will happen, and so on and so on and so on. So don't put yourself forward all the time.
So you've spoken of the danger of an over-egotism. Is there also a feeling of protection of oneself at the core?
It's a part of Aboriginal protocol that there are lots of different things in there where you don't look directly at people, don't stare at people directly, don't ask direct questions, don't ask very intimate questions directly. Quite often Aboriginal people think that's acting like police and so on, but always giving the other person, allowing the other person their space and their dignity, so that, for example, not putting people on the spot so that they might have to say no, because nobody likes to say no. It's highly embarrassing. The idea of shame is extremely, extremely important for Aboriginal people. A shameful behaviour or everywhere in the whole country. The idea of shame, where if you put an individual, another individual Aboriginal person, on the spot, in a sense it tears that person open inside, and they are exposed, so to speak. They're sort of exposed. The very core of their whole being is exposed, and that's really taking away the dignity of them. So that you actually, in a way, you talk in, if you're discussing something, say if some crisis or some topic, quite often you'll talk in a roundabout way, in a very subtle way. You don't come straight to the point about things. Because in that sort of protocol, you're actually already, you're in a sense testing the waters or testing the atmosphere. And when people do come together to talk about things, establishing an agreeable atmosphere is the most important part of it. So the meeting or the gathering or the meeting won't start until, for example, gossip will have taken place. People are talking about just mundane things, everyday things. The meeting doesn't start when the issue is brought up. The meeting has already started when people are actually gossiping. So because you actually are establishing a really agreeable atmosphere, and what it actually means is that you actually grow peace. You don't make peace. You actually have to grow peace. You grow it over a long period of time. You can't make it, because again, that comes back to the idea of sides. So as much as it might be disappointing for government and bureaucracy, but the idea of democracy doesn't hold much water for Aboriginal people either. Democracy is seen as not the greatest thing in the world. Consensus decision making is seen as far more important, because everybody in an Aboriginal world, everybody is their own law bearer. Nobody tells you what to do or orders you to do things. I mean, an older person has got a great authority, that's for sure, but they don't have the kind of authority in that they can order you to do things every day of your life. That they can they have authority over you to do with their knowledge about things and so on and so on. The very idea of democracy is seen as a bit immature for Aboriginal people. It's seen as concretized conflict. It's saying that actually conflict is good and that you have to have two sides there to sort it out. But what actually happens is two sides to a conflict or a crisis actually sets it. It's there forever, actually. Whereas in a consensus-style decision-making, the whole aim of it from an Aboriginal perspective is to grow that agreeable atmosphere and always to aim for that harmonious sort of relationship. And in that, though, on the way to that harmonious sort of relationship, you might actually have arguments because, again, everybody's allowed to do that. It's okay to do that. It's okay to burst into tears and, you know, sometimes it's a bit like Italian opera without the music, you know.
Yes.
It's quite amazing. But the aim of it is that harmoniousness in the end. So what it actually means, though, is it's all means and very little ends, because relations are far more important than the issue or the topic or the problem. You know?
Yes, so the process is
The process
respected
is
seen to be important.
Much, yeah, very much the process. So and that usually infuriates, I'm afraid, state and Canberra bureaucrats, because when they want a decision made by Friday 5 o'clock, quite often it's never made by Friday 5 o'clock. It's
Mary,
two or three weeks late. Or
what you're describing so clearly is this collision and misfiring of two different systems of thought, two different ways of seeing and understanding what it is to be human in the world. Yes.
Yes, it's a totally different metaphysics from Western metaphysics, Aboriginal metaphysics. And you see, it still operates, regardless of what some people want to say, in every corner of the whole country. It really is. It's because culture is a two-sided thing. It's the externals are dress and customs and what you eat and what you wear and so on and so on. But the other part of culture, the most important part is how you feel and think and act and so on. And that hasn't changed very much at all, regardless of how urbanised people in some parts have become.
We are all from the Noongar clan of Minjerribah, also known as North Stradbroke Island. And we dance this dance to say welcome to you all. This dance was danced to bring all the family groups of Southeast Queensland together at the Bunyanut Festivals. Welcome. Garing Indanami.
Garing Indanami, Nudamu Berunun, Garing Indanami. Garding in the name, do the muberono. Garding in the name, do the muberono. Garding in the name, do the muberono.
And in this edition of The Search for Meaning, we're hearing Mary Graham, an elder of the Combermere people of Southeast Queensland, lecturer in Aboriginal Studies at Queensland University, speaking about Aboriginal perspectives. Western educated people have been taught to understand time in a linear way, past, present, future. But is it the same for Aboriginal people? As Mary and I talked, we had beside us a photograph of her ancestors taken in the 1880s, and I asked her if, when she looked at it, they seemed to be in the past or not.
Well, they are and they aren't at the same time, because it can't be... First of all, there are several different senses of time in the Aboriginal metaphysics. There are about eight or nine different senses of time, actually, and lineal time is only one of many, because a clock time, all that really does is it's a machine for counting its own ticks. That's all it does. It goes around, so 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock doesn't actually exist at all. You know?
Right.
But noon and dusk and dawn and all that, of course, that exists. And Aboriginal people have always known that, and of course lots of old cultures have. And physicists know it, I suppose, and babies know it, and so on. But the other senses of time, there's nothing magical about them. There are revelatory time, time of cause and effect, cyclical time, biological time, of course, just growing older, time in the fourth dimension, and that's the most important for Aboriginal
people. The fourth
dimension? That is time in the eternal now, in the sense of the eternal now. So when I look at this photo, that certainly did happen in, what is it, the 1880s. But again, as I said, 1880s don't actually exist for in Aboriginal terms. But it did happen in Western terms in 1880s. But in an Aboriginal term, in the idea of the eternal now, that has just happened and is still happening. To put it a different way, and it is a bit hard to explain it, it's like it's just a bit like a radio station where you are on one band, the ABC, and you can switch over to another band and you get 4BC or something. But when you're switching on to another one, that doesn't mean to say that the others aren't existing. You know, they're actually there, so it's all different senses of time. But the whole thing is time in the eternal now. So, or the other way of putting it is, for example, like the French Revolution happened in 1789 or whatever. But ever since then, everybody's been writing about it. There are volumes written about it. And this century, they've made TV shows about it, films about it. So in actual fact, the French Revolution happened in 1789, but it's actually still happening, isn't it? It's actually still happening. So in other words, this here is still actually happening.
Mm.
So in a sense, it's like in Surfers Paradise or Sydney. The place is covered in concrete and buildings and so on and so on, but it's as if those things don't actually exist at all. They're not actually there. They are there, and they're not there.
Really? Is that how you feel?
Oh, yeah. That's the way most Aboriginal people do feel.
Mm.
I mean, we might talk about, oh, yes, all these things were there a long time ago and so on and so on. But you see, if we actually did think that, then it wouldn't be any problem about Aboriginal people becoming simply Black Australians, you see, because all those things have been before. But actually, that's why land and land rights is so important. Mm. It's so important, the idea of land. It's far more than just, you know, people feel fond of a particular place. It really is meaning of life stuff, and it's psychology, and it's the only thing that exists, really.
So Darwinian theory would pass you by altogether, I imagine, would it?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Yes?
Oh, yes.
You are not, in fact, descended from the apes.
Oh, God. That theory from, I think from our perspective, would be seen as the expression of a really immature culture trying to justify colonialism, basically. And they're finding it really, really hard because they have to stay being Christian to think well of themselves at the same time as they're doing dreadful, dreadful things to millions and millions of people around the world.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So it's that's basically, it's seen as a very, very, very immature.
Mm.
Because Aboriginal society, it really is a very, very mature society. They've worked out a whole lot of things to do with human relations above all, meaning in life, you know, about life and so on. And one way of expressing that more is that when there are records of people coming and talking to Aboriginal people and trying to give them things, and the Aboriginal people just actually didn't want anything. There's nothing. I think, I don't know, it might have been Captain Cook or different ones, I think, that said, well, they don't seem to want anything we've got, you know.
And that was puzzling.
That was puzzling for the Europeans, I think.
Yes.
You know, because you know, there is still this fond myth that Aboriginal people, or Indigenous people in general, all are dying to become Western. You know, they certainly might want certain things of the West,
yes,
but they don't necessarily all want to become Western.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're quite happy being Aboriginal, Indian, Chinese, or whatever.
So if I say to you, success, now what meaning does that have for you? Do you feel yourself to be a successful person? Now, I'm taking all sorts of risks here. I'm asking you another direct question.
Yes.
What will you do with that?
I think success... success for me is to do with having good human relations, having good relations with people, proper relations, and doing the correct thing for my mob, basically. You know, success isn't measured in terms of in material gain, or, you know, winning the lotto tomorrow would be very nice.
Why?
Well, it would help, you know, but it's not seen as being successful because so all of a sudden you have money to be able to buy things and so on. Because if that did happen and you bought things, I'd do exactly probably what most other Aboriginals would do and start sharing it out. And, you know, your car is other people's car and your clothes are other people's clothes and so on, food and everything. Your house is my house and so on and so on. So those sorts of things, they're just taken for granted, you know. So the idea of going somewhere in the world, going somewhere, because you've got to have a reason to go somewhere. See, from an Aboriginal point of view, we're all not going anywhere at all. We're all just sort of staying right here. You know, they're there because there's nowhere to go, actually.
We're not heading for heaven or paradise or hell.
No, nobody's going anywhere because there isn't any heaven, and paradise doesn't exist at all. It doesn't exist.
So when you're saying we're not going anywhere, where does that leave death?
Well, yes, we're going to die.
Yes, and afterwards? You have a sense of afterwards, or the question doesn't have meaning?
Well, it does, but basically it's you're with your ancestors. You're with other people because you're in this great grid with other people, and they're waiting for you and so on and so on. But the emphasis is not very much on death. It really is on life itself and living and living it to the full. Life is, I don't know, it's like as if it's a one-shot thing.
Mary, you're a chess player.
Mm.
Yes. What's the pleasure in chess?
Oh, well, probably it's the duel, the idea of the duel. Somebody wrote a book once about the finite game and the infinite game. And there are only two different kinds of games in the world, and that's those two, finite and infinite. Finite games are things like chess games, and they're wonderful. They're like duels, and you can shine in them, you know, you can show your prowess and so on and so on. And, of course, a real duel with the pistols and swords, that's a finite game too. And some would even say, I don't know if you take it that far, but maybe the never-ending duel between men and women, maybe that's a finite game. Because and a war or a courtroom drama, a court trial is a finite game.